speak with you today. And as Rob mentioned, I'm going to tell you about the first observational tests of an idea called eternal inflation. And I'll explain to you exactly what that means and what the tests are in a second. Now, one of the funnest parts of working on this idea is that it allows me to interact with a really wide variety of people from a wide variety of fields, including observational cosmologists, quite formal string theorists, theorists in cosmology and particle physics, and people working on gravitational theory and numerical relativity. In particular, I'd like to highlight the work of a graduate student that I've been involved with, Stephen Feeney at University College London. He did a lot of really nice work on the observational tests that I'll talk about at the end of the talk. Here is my basic research question. How big is the universe? Well, we used to think it was that big. And then we looked out, built telescopes, and gradually expanded our view of the cosmos to include the solar system. And then telescopes got better, and we realized that there are other stars. Stars belong to galaxies. There's other galaxies, clusters of galaxies. And there has been this steady progression of increasing size of the universe. And what I'll talk about today is how ideas in modern cosmology, namely dark energy and inflation, coupled with modern ideas in theoretical particle physics, namely the concept that our vacuum state might not be unique, conspire to give rise to a picture where our observable universe is only one piece of a much larger entity, which we'll call the multiverse. So the universe is much bigger than we think. And the punchline is that this idea is, in fact, experimentally verifiable. So how will we get there? Here's an outline of my talk. First, I'll talk briefly about cosmology, what we know and how we know it. I'll talk about eternal inflation, what exactly is this idea, and why is it well motivated. I'll tell you how you can test it with observations of the cosmic microwave background radiation. And then finally, I'll present the result of an analysis of real data. And you'll have to stay awake until the end of the talk to figure out what the result is. I won't tell you now. So what do we know? Well, we think we know that we live in a universe that is nearly flat. It's undergoing accelerated expansion. And it's composed almost entirely of dark energy and dark matter. Only about 4% of the universe, we think today, is composed of atoms. And structure in the universe was seeded by nearly scale invariant, Gaussian, and adiabatic density perturbations. So how do we know it? Well, one great tool we have at our disposal in cosmology is something known as the cosmic microwave background radiation. Here I've shown a space-time schematic cartoon of the universe. And early in the universe, things were quite dense and hot, and the universe was essentially a plasma. And a plasma is opaque to radiation. As the universe expanded and cooled, the electrons and protons recombined to form neutral atoms, and all of the radiation that was stuck in this plasma gets released. This happens at a place or a time, if you will, denoted by the surface of last scattering. This is the place at which those photons scattered last. And those photons leave the surface of last scattering and eventually reach us today, where we observe them. The early universe was not completely homogeneous. There were fluctuations in the density. That's what seeded large-scale structure. And as the photons propagate to us, they have to propagate through the evolving gravitational potential wells that were induced by these primordial perturbations. And this, of course, manifests itself in the temperature anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background. So the cosmic microwave background is a picture of the density perturbations, both at the surface of last scattering and as they evolve in time. Of course, this is how we know. By analyzing the statistical properties of those hot and cold spots, because they're going to be different depending on what the contents of the universe are. On the right, my right, here I've plotted a plot of the angular power spectrum of the CMB from the WMAP 7-year data. And by analyzing the structure of those peaks, and in particular this part tells us a lot about the primordial perturbations, we get a picture of what the early universe was and what it was composed of. And our canonical cosmological model is the concordance model, the standard model of cosmology, or lambda CDM. So this is how we know. And we think that the initial conditions, those density perturbations, were caused by an epoch known as inflation, an epoch of accelerated expansion in the early universe that flattens the universe, makes it isotropic, and seeds it with initial density perturbations. So that's the cosmological, standard cosmological paradigm. And within this paradigm, there are two epochs of accelerated expansion, okay? One of which we have inferential evidence for, and one of which we have direct observational evidence for. And I cannot emphasize enough the fundamental nature of the questions that these two epochs of accelerated expansion lead us to. For example, we might ask, well, how did the thermodynamic era of time arise? Is the current accelerated expansion due to some kind of vacuum energy? And if so, how does that jive with particle physics? Does the fundamental universe, theory of the universe, have a finite number of degrees of freedom, as might be suggested by a theory that's described with a cosmological constant? How big is the universe? Are there other universes? Are there other forces? What is dark energy and what is responsible for inflation? All of these truly big questions come from the empirical knowledge that we live in an accelerating universe and might have come from one. And answering any one of these questions would yield truly invaluable insight into the fundamental laws of nature. Of course, big questions are often difficult to address directly, and one can find one answerable question that has surprisingly broad impact for a variety of these very big questions. And that is to ask, well, how does accelerated expansion begin and end? And this is a question both for theory and for observation, because we can tell, possibly. So let's just list a few possibilities for how accelerated expansion might begin and end. So here on the right, I have some color gradient, which denotes a sort of space-time diagram. Red is expanding very fast, blue is expanding a bit slower. And one possibility is that accelerated expansion begins more or less homogeneously in space, and ends more or less homogeneously in space. And this is the standard picture of slow roll inflation, if you will, where I have a scalar field whose potential energy drives an accelerating universe and whose energy is slowly decreasing as the field rolls down the hill. Okay, another possibility is that accelerated expansion begins, but it doesn't end anywhere. Okay, this would be the case for a truly fundamental cosmological constant. Okay. The universe would evolve, whatever it's filled with would get diluted, and I end up with a pure de Sitter space, a space-time described by just a cosmological constant. Another possibility is that accelerated expansion begins homogeneously, but only ends locally in space, kind of like a first-order phase transition. And this is what I'll be focusing on for the majority of the rest of my talk, this particular possibility. So how could this be realized in a theory? Let's say I have some scalar field with a potential energy given by what's on the right, and there is a local minimum of this potential energy, which exists at positive potential. And if the universe everywhere has a value of the field here, then classically what's going to happen is that the positive potential energy associated with the scalar field is going to drive accelerated expansion of the universe. Okay, and I get inflation. However, quantum mechanically, that's not the whole story. Quantum mechanically, this field can tunnel through the barrier, just like a one-dimensional quantum mechanics problem, except for we're doing quantum field theory. And because we're talking about quantum field theory, this doesn't happen everywhere in space. That would cost an infinite amount of energy. This happens locally inside of bubbles. these bubbles form. The initial radius of the bubble is determined by energetics. What is the minimum energy configuration that I can make? Inside the bubble, since I'm on the other side of this barrier, I'm in a phase with slightly lower density. Outside the bubble, I remain trapped in this minimum. And because of this density gradient, this bubble wants to expand. And by bubble, I really mean a physical object. This bubble is a configuration of the scalar field, and its wall carries energy because of this barrier. One can calculate the probability for this occurrence, and in the WKV approximation, again, the analogy is direct with one-dimensional quantum mechanics, it's given by some prefactor times an exponential suppression. And the value of that suppression was first calculated by Coleman in 1980, and it depends on a surface tension, which is determined roughly by the properties of this barrier. That's the stuff the bubble is made of, and the energy difference between the inside and outside. And in order for this approximation to make sense, S has to be somewhat bigger than 1, and so typically this is a very rare occurrence. This is an exponentially suppressed process. Okay, so what would happen if I had a static or a decelerating universe? I have two phases, a black phase and a white phase. And within this phase, a bubble forms, and because it's energetically favorable, it wants to expand. At some later time, it gets some friends, so other bubbles form from this vacuum, they expand, until eventually this phase is completely eaten up. Okay? So this phase transition completes in this case. And no matter how slow, no matter how small the probability to form bubbles, this will eventually happen. And we can contrast that with what happens in an accelerating universe. Again, I have two phases. The universe starts quite small. It expands, more bubbles form. It expands even further, more bubbles form. And I can run into a situation where the universe is expanding faster than the bubbles are forming. And because it's accelerated expansion, these bubbles can be forever out of causal contact. And when that occurs, I get this phenomenon of eternal inflation. So when the rate of formation is slower than the rate of expansion, then this original accelerating phase is never completely eaten up. The phase transition cannot complete. And in this picture, to go back to our original question, the universe is infinitely big because this original inflating phase gets to keep on expanding forever. It never gets completely eaten up. Of course, that's intrinsically interesting, how to go from some tiny little piece of an accelerating space-time to an infinitely big universe. But it's also very well motivated by theoretical physics. In fact, the original proposal for inflation was to start with some phase and stop the accelerated expansion by the formation of bubbles. And a problem with this original proposal was exactly this problem of eternal inflation. It's really difficult to get the bubbles to form fast enough so that the original phase is completely eaten up. The reason that that's a problem is because in this original model, if I look inside of a single bubble, it contains a completely empty and dead open universe, which looks nothing like our universe today. Why is it an open universe? Well, an open Robertson-Walker metric has the same symmetries as a spherically symmetric bubble that expands with constant acceleration. So this is just fixed by the properties of that solution. Let's explore that in a little bit more detail. So on the left here, I've drawn a space-time diagram. Okay, and here is a space-space diagram. It's looking from the top down at this picture, if you will. So at some initial time in this foliation, I have a bubble that forms with some initial radius R naught. And again, in this foliation of space and time, if I go to later and later times, the bubble looks like it expands. And the wall is undergoing motion with constant acceleration. And so it asymptotes to the null cone that emanates from the center of this bubble. However, there's another foliation of space-time into space and time, which naturally lives inside of this null cone. And that is a time slicing that corresponds to an infinite open Robertson-Walker universe. Inside of this bubble, it's possible to fit an infinite open Robertson-Walker universe. And that null cone is simply the place where the scale factor associated with this Robertson-Walker universe goes to zero. That's usually what we'd call the Big Bang, where a curvature singularity is in a standard Robertson-Walker cosmology. But here, it's simply a coordinate singularity. And the thing that lies on the other side is the wall of this expanding bubble. Okay, but as it stands, this is just a curvature-dominated universe forever. It's completely empty and not very cosmologically interesting if it's to describe our universe. Oh, so just to give you a picture, if I cut through this in the original time foliation, I have this nested sequence of constant time surfaces in the other foliation. So how do I make this into a viable cosmology? I design a potential such that on the other side of this barrier, there's an epoch of slow roll inflation. And now these constant time surfaces inside the bubble correspond to different cosmological epochs of the standard cosmological model. I have inflation, inflation ends, reheats the universe, I get the standard picture of cosmology. And this is completely phenomenologically acceptable. Our universe could be in there. Now, this was popular in the 90s, and it went under the name of open inflation, because at that time we thought we had good evidence for the universe being spatially open. Okay, another motivation is that eternal inflation seems to be nearly inevitable in string theory. Why? String theory postulates that there are extra spatial dimensions. And what is typically done to hide those extra spatial dimensions from our view is to compactify them. There's simply many, many, many ways that one can imagine compactifying these extra dimensions. The extra dimensions can assume many shapes, sizes, topologies. Okay? And each of these should give you slightly different four-dimensional physics, because that's why we invented the extra dimensions in the first place. They gave us interesting information about what four-dimensional physics could be. Further, all of these configurations can be deformed into one another at the cost of some energy. And this gives rise to a potential landscape of string theory. This is the string theory landscape. Okay? And there are different places in this potential energy landscape. The fields that are plotted here correspond to the properties of the extra dimensions. And I can move around. This is a lot like the problem of protein folding, where a protein can assume many different configurations that are all connected by some potential energy landscape. That's a very interesting question. It's not. But some are, and that can be shown conclusively. Now, if in that landscape there are positive energy vacua, then generically those positive energy vacua will drive eternal inflation if the universe happens to find itself in that position in the potential landscape. And from that initial phase, many, many states can be populated. So here I have some original phase, which forms bubbles. But since the original phase doesn't get entirely eaten up ever, any possible type of bubble will eventually form. And so I get this drastic expansion of this previous idea even, that if I just have two phases, I populate a whole bunch of these bubbles with that phase. Now I have a multitude of phases that can be populated. And in this picture, one could probably argue that vacuum decay is likely to be in our past. Now, there's another variant of eternal inflation that I won't touch on much in this talk, but again, it adds to the theoretical motivation. So again, here is this cartoon of the universe. This is the inflating phase driven by some scalar field. And at some time, I have the field at some position on the potential, and the quantum fluctuations in this field manifest themselves as density perturbations that we see on the surface of last scattering. And if I run this back in time, well, the field probably started a little bit higher on the potential, and the higher I go, the larger the amplitude of those quantum fluctuations, until I get to a point where the quantum fluctuations, in fact, overwhelm the classical drift down the potential. And this, again, gives rise to this picture of eternal inflation, because there are parts of the universe that just keep climbing up the hill. Okay. Finally, one should care about this because decay could, in fact, be to our future. Here are some exciting hints from the ATLAS experiment for what the mass of the Higgs boson might be. And there is some 2-ish sigma evidence that it could be at around 126 GeV. Okay. So if I take the couplings of the standard model, and I assume that the standard model is all that there is up to the Planck scale, the quartic coupling for the Higgs goes to zero at an energy below the Planck scale. And what this signals is that our standard model vacuum is in fact a false vacuum, and there's a place that we will decay to. I think the most recent bounds can be found in this paper, and for a Higgs mass of around 126 GeV and what we understand about the mass of the top, this yields an age of about 10 to the 100 years, a lifetime of the universe of about 10 to the 100 years. That's right.
This is the right Higgs.
So I think if the Higgs mass is very much above about 130 GeV, then the place where this quartic coupling goes to zero is above the Planck scale. And then, you know, we'd be speculating about more than just the fact that there's nothing between the standard model and the Planck scale.
You must be careful. This is stupid.
That's fine. This is just that's fine. But this is just theoretical motivation why you might think this could occur.
There may be lots of other junk between us and the Planck scale.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's
he
my
said
assumption.
Maybe. He said
yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. but I think that makes it worse. So I'll get to there in a second. And what this gives rise to is the following picture. I have this expanding phase, which is spawning all of these different types of bubbles. There's bubbles within bubbles and whatnot. And I get this distribution of sizes and types. And in fact, this distribution becomes statistically homogeneous at late times. There's an attractor for it. And I get a fractal distribution of all of these different types of bubbles. And the claim of this theory is that if I look somewhere in this mess of bubbles, somewhere I will find our observable universe. We exist in this eternally inflating phase. And so here we are inside this bubble. Seriously? I mean, so let's just back up and review what I just told you. Okay, so I told you that we might live in a universe that has an infinite number of individually infinite sub-universes in an infinite expanding background, and surely I can't be serious, but I am. And that's because eternal inflation is a direct consequence of a fairly conservative application of theories of physics that we think we understand. So what did I need? I needed a non-unique vacuum state. That was important. Well, that's possible in the standard model. It's fairly common in models of physics beyond the standard model, so depending on how supersymmetry is broken, or even in the MSSM, depending on what the potential landscape for the scalar particles looks like. And it's nearly inevitable, it seems, in string theory as we understand it. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but then that just satisfies this first requirement. So that's not the only requirement. The other way that this could be, well, the other thing we need is quantum field theory. Okay, so we. I think I don't need the extra dimensions because this can happen in just in the standard model. So that's a particular realization of this, but it's not necessary. This could happen in four-dimensional field theories that, you know, we apply every day. So I needed a non-unique vacuum state. I also need quantum field theory. Well, that's been fantastically tested at the perturbative level. There's a slight extrapolation here because this is this tunneling, this quantum tunneling of the field is a non-perturbative effect, but that seems fairly conservative. And I need accelerated expansion, which is both observed in the form of dark energy and inferred in the case of inflation. So I'd just like to emphasize that this is a consequence of a fairly conservative application of the theories of physics we think we understand. That's right. That's a caveat. Given a theory, one could compute that and see. So there's, I would argue, fairly strong theoretical motivation for this idea of eternal inflation. But one should ground oneself in experiment. And an important question to ask is if this idea is in any way observationally verifiable. And promisingly, the answer is yes. The reason being, if I look at this construction and I focus on any given one of these bubbles, it will undergo an infinite number of collisions with other bubbles, some subset of which can be directly accessible to observation inside of one of these bubbles. And this provides a direct observational test of eternal inflation. One can calculate the probability, which I will calculate for you in about 10 slides. So what's the road to getting there? Here's the outline for the rest of my talk. First, I'll tell you what happens when bubbles collide, what the aftermath is. I'll show you that there's a fairly generic signature of collisions between bubbles that manifests itself in the cosmic microwave background. I'll tell you how to count collisions and therefore find this probability of this occurring. And then finally, I'll present a search in WMAP data for this generic signature, and finally tell you what I'm most excited about to do next. Okay, so here is our bubble. Okay, again, remember that this null cone extending from the center is our Big Bang. And inside the bubble, we have an epoch of slow roll inflation followed by reheating and the standard cosmology. And along comes another bubble and collides with us. Yeah? These are real, genuine solutions to general relativity with scalar fields. There's no assumptions in terms of what's going on. I really have, you know, the action for Einstein gravity plus a scalar field, and these are genuine solutions. So there's no extrapolation, there's no approximation. That's right.
You don't have the tunneling solution.
That's a fair and deep question, and I'll say that in the limit where these bubbles are rather small compared to the scale of the horizon, this is probably a fairly good approximation. And I think I could even write down approximate Euclidean solutions that describe that. So we want to know what happens in the aftermath of one such collision. So one thing to note is that these collisions are always in our past. The reason being that the Big Bang for our observable universe is just inside of this bubble wall. And so anything that propagates into our universe has to pass through this Big Bang, effectively. Okay? So this is always in our past. The second thing to note is that this is completely deterministic. Okay? The outcome is fixed entirely by the potential energy of the scalar fields, which tells me what these bubbles are made of and how they interact. And the kinematics, which if I go to a center of mass-like frame, is just the initial separation of these two bubbles. And given those things, I can predict the outcome uniquely. But to study what happens, you really need full general relativity. The reason is that our ambitions are quite high. In the future of this collision, I have a completely inhomogeneous and anisotropic universe. And we want to find quantitatively what the exact cosmology up here looks like. So to do that, I need to figure out how the fields back react on the geometry, etc. This is really a problem for general relativity. The center of mass energy in this collision can be absolutely enormous. It can be up to the Planck scale, if you wish. Further, the potential that makes up these bubbles is highly nonlinear, okay, as is Einstein equations. And so this is really a problem for full general relativity. This is a problem in strong gravity. And fortunately, there's a set of symmetries that allow us to actually make progress. So here is a space-space diagram. I've drawn two bubbles. They form at some initial radius R0, and they're separated by a distance 2b. And the trajectory of the wall of any given bubble is described by a hyperboloid in flat space. The reason being is that this is a spherically symmetric object that starts at rest and expands with constant acceleration. That's the trajectory of a hyperboloid. So if I move to later and later times, these bubbles expand and eventually collide. And if I look at this plane, the place where these collisions overlap, and I trace the trajectory of the intersection, I get a hyperboloid of one lower dimension. That's a standard fact of Euclidean geometry. If I intersect two hyperboloids, I get a hyperboloid of one less dimension at their intersection. And what that means, if you extrapolate away from this simplistic picture, as first shown by Hawking, Moss, and Stewart, is that the full collision spacetime has an SO21 symmetry. That's the symmetry of this hyperboloid, the symmetry of the intersection. And what that means is that there's enough symmetries for two bubbles to reduce the problem to one space and one time dimension, and then it's actually possible maybe to solve Einstein's equations. And there's two methods that have been used. Well, there's analytic solutions that one can write down, which effectively tell you stuff about the kinematically allowed, that is, things that are allowed by energy and momentum conservation, outcomes, the causal structure, so a global picture of what the spacetime of two colliding bubbles look like. And then there's numerical simulations, which are really required to understand the full dynamics because of the nonlinear nature of the potential and the nonlinear nature of Einstein equations. So let's briefly go through some progress in these two directions. So here I have some scalar field potential, and it's got three phases, A, B, C. From the B phase, which is this vacuum up here, I can form bubbles of A and C. This is just a hypothetical example. It's not motivated. It's just one thing I could write down. And these bubbles are described in this formalism, in this analytic formalism known as the Israel junction condition formalism, as thin shells characterized by some tension, sigma, and vacuum energies. So those are characterized by H, the Hubble constant in each of these vacua. I have to specify some initial separation in this center of mass-like frame. These bubbles expand, collide, and since these two phases are different, the outcome must be that I form some interface that separates the interior of these two bubbles, and that also will be characterized by some other tension. So that's enough to solve this problem. In the approximation that these bubbles are described really just as thin shells filled with constant vacuum energy. So here is another space-time diagram. At some initial time, I've got my red bubble and my blue bubble separated by a distance delta x. They both expand, and here they collide. So what happens? Well, you can say what doesn't happen with a great deal of certainty. It was shown back in the 90s that the collision between two bubbles can produce no black hole. There's simply no way to make enough center of mass energy to produce a black hole. And in these geometries, making a black hole would really mean making a black hole with a naked singularity. That follows from the symmetries. I don't have time to show you now, but it does. Further, you can show that there's no gravitational wave production in this collision between two bubbles. And that arises because there's a hyperbolic version of Birkhoff's theorem, which tells you that there's simply no antenna to make gravitational waves in a space-time that has this symmetry. So what does happen? Well, one can apply energy and momentum conservation to show that there is a generic mix of ingredients given what I have. There have to be shells of radiation that are spewed out and some post-collision domain wall that forms. And the exact dynamics of this process in this picture are fixed just by energy and momentum conservation, effectively. And quantitatively, what one finds is, well, the bubble with lower vacuum energy typically wins. The quantity one needs to compute to determine this has to do both with these vacuum energy densities and also the tension. The tension comes in because gravitationally domain walls are repulsive, and so that can overwhelm this purely non-relativistic tendency of the thing with lower energy density to expand. But quantitatively, that's what one finds in doing this analysis. And listing all the possibilities with this set of ingredients allows you to piece together a complete classification of the causal structure. So how these walls evolve, how these bubbles are pasted together. And these solutions gave the first hints of what the possible observational signatures could be, which I'll discuss in more detail in a little while. So another kind of neat thing that can happen is that if I have a potential with this vacuum structure, okay, there's three phases, but now I start in A, I form two bubbles of B. If the potential is right, I can kick myself to another vacuum, C. And again, because of the novelty of gravitational effects, you can even kick yourself from a non-inflating phase back up to an inflating one. So these dead bubbles of the original Guth model, if they collide and have the right potential structure, can actually restart inflation. So that's a brief overview of what happens in this approximation. But this can only tell us what's kinematically allowed, so what is allowed by energy momentum conservation. It doesn't tell us what actually happens and quantitatively what the space-time looks like. To do that, you need numerical relativity. There's a convenient gauge where I can write the metric for this two-bubble space-time as follows. This is a two-hyperbola, so that encodes the symmetry that exists in the two-bubble space-time, and I have to evolve the metric and a scalar field. The scalar field has a potential that looks like this, very similar to what I was drawing before, except for now we're going to allow the possibility of slow roll. So first of all, just as before, there is two types of bubbles that can arise from this false vacuum, which we'll call B. Okay, I can make bubbles of A, and I can make bubbles of C. And if on the right I stick a slow roll potential, I get a model of open inflation, which I described before. So this potential looks really funny because it turns out that the condition for fast tunneling is sort of at odds with the condition for slow roll inflation, if the model of slow roll inflation is something like m squared phi squared. There, the potential range has to be of order the Planck scale, whereas to get fast tunneling, the width of the barrier has to be very much smaller than the Planck scale. Okay, so these models that we'll be testing later are somewhat funny and look like this. Okay, so here are the results of a numerical simulation of the collision between two bubbles. This is work that I've done in collaboration with Louis Lehner, Steve Liebling, and Hirania Paris. This is a plot of phi versus x. X is the axis that separates the two bubbles. This is phi b, the false vacuum. This position is phi c, and here you can see I have these two initial bubbles. So let's take away that and run the movie. These bubbles expand, collide, and then I have some field evolution. And the outcome is really easy to predict. Right after the collision, those two fields simply linearly superposed. Those two profiles just simply linearly superposed. The maximum amplitude in the center was at twice the width of the barrier. And this is very much related to this classical transition phenomenon that I mentioned before. Further, one can show that this happens for arbitrary kinematics. So there's a restricted range in field space that the field gets kicked. Okay? And what that shows you is that the structure of the potential, when you include the dynamics, is far more important than the kinematics. And this is going to be important later. To find this out, dynamics were really necessary. This is a nonlinear effect. So it was really necessary to do these numerical simulations to find that. Okay, one can also collide different bubbles. Okay, so here is that C bubble that contains slow roll inflation, and here's a friend. Again, this is a field X plot. On the right, I've zoomed in at a particularly interesting region. And if I run the movie, these bubbles expand, collide, and it sends out some train of waves from the position of the collision. And you can see that the interface separating the interior of these two bubbles also has some interesting dynamics. Yeah? So if we go back, yeah, so phi c should be positive, phi a is negative. And then we get here. So phi a is negative, phi c is positive, yep. Okay, so you get to see the movie again. Here are the bubbles, they collide, they interact, they send out this traveling waves. And if I look at the values of the field here, I haven't really ended nothing really dramatic has happened to the epoch of inflation inside of this bubble. It's simply gotten these extra perturbations. Okay? So I seed the initial conditions for inflation with these extra perturbations. And jackpot, that's how we're going to look for a signal. So I start with some potential. This potential gives rise to bubbles that collide. Here is a space-time diagram of something similar to that movie that I showed you. Here is, say, our bubble. These are the nice, open Robertson-Walker constant density hypersurfaces that exist in an unperturbed bubble. And along comes his friend and perturbs him. So those surfaces of constant density are now different. And if I look at some appropriately chosen slice through this that corresponds, say, to a cosmology, I'd see that those constant density hypersurfaces are flat and then become perturbed, just as I've shown you in this movie. And that traveling wave train gets stretched by inflation, and it splits the universe into two parts. One that lies outside the future light cone of this collision, that's unperturbed, and one that lies inside, which is perturbed in some way. So a basic question we can ask, well, what in general would that look like? So here is the surface of last scattering. It's been split into two parts, gray, which is affected by the collision, and blue, which is not. And one can look top down at this, and in an open universe, you can represent an entire infinite spatial slice in the Poincaré disk representation. And the affected region is again shaded in gray, the unaffected in white. And this circle here is the projection of our past light cone on the surface of last scattering. And because we think we live in a very flat universe, if I draw this to scale, that circle is really tiny. Okay? What that means is that I see a super zoomed in version of this evolving wave train, which has absolutely no curvature from my perspective. So it's really a planar type perturbation. And if I were able to rotate this out of the plane, you'd see that that would be describing a disk. Okay, the surface of last scattering on our CMB sky is just a sphere, and the intersection of a sphere with a plane is a disk. So just by symmetry and causality, whatever the effects are, they're confined to a disk. And again, thanks to the stretching of inflation, there is a generic signature. In the limit where this perturbation is fairly small, which it must be if it's there because we don't see it, a blazing signal in the CMB, the temperature anisotropies are some template plus the standard fluctuations of lambda CDM. And a variety of papers using analytic arguments and numerical work have shown that the template takes a fairly generic form that looks something like this. Okay? The temperature modulation induced by the collision varies roughly as the cosine of the angle away from the center. Okay? And it's described by an amplitude, a size, possibly a shape, which I'll call this discontinuity, and the position on the sky. So with 5 parameters, you basically encapsulate the model of one collision. And if you put this in the CMB, so if I took that template plus the fluctuations, you get something that looks like this, where I've zoomed in on a portion of the CMB sky here, and you can see this roughly circular feature. So it could be buried in the data. In fact, that's what it has to be, because we don't see it immediately. Okay, so how many are there? That's what happens for one. Now, how would we count how many of these features we expect to exist in the cosmic microwave background? Again, here's this potential, and now I've drawn a conformal diagram. So this is the complete causal structure of a one-bubble spacetime. Here is the surface on which the bubble nucleates. Here is the expanding wall, and inside the bubble I have these constant time surfaces in the Robertson-Walker foliation. And again, to review, I have these different epochs, which correspond to different constant time hypersurfaces. And if I put myself somewhere in this picture, here I am now, and I follow my past light cone, well, if there's some initial condition for eternal inflation, which there has to be basically because of Olber's paradox, then anything that happens in here, any other bubble that nucleates in here, will be in principle observable to us. It lies within our past light cone. And so the total number of in principle detectable collisions is given by the probability to make bubbles per unit 4 volume times the 4 volume that I've shaded here in gray. And one can calculate this, and counting only those disks which intersect the CMB sky, it turns out you can have disks that in effect circumscribe much more than the celestial sphere, but only counting those that intersect the celestial sphere, you get a number of collisions given by this. So there's a probability per unit 4 volume normalized to the false vacuum Hubble scale, that's the energy density outside the bubble, and this gets multiplied by a ratio of that same energy scale to the energy scale of inflation inside the bubble times the square root of the present day curvature, omega c. So this we know to be probably less than about 0.1. This is unknown, but it's exponentially suppressed. And so typically what is required to have an appreciable number is to make this ratio of scales fairly large, which is possible. And if I look at a given point from which a bubble could nucleate, it will map on to a different size disk on my CMB sky. So by calculating distribution of 4 volume that makes disks of a given size, I can figure out a probability distribution over the sizes. And it looks roughly in the limit of small omega curvature. These are increasing values of omega curvature, these different color curves. In the limit of small omega curvature, this looks basically like sine theta, sine of the size. So the most likely thing to see is something that's roughly half the sky. Also, these collisions that intersect our celestial sphere are distributed nearly isotropically. One can also show that using the same calculation. So here's the basic model, just to recap. So I have some potential. It gives rise to this picture of eternal inflation with bubbles. I'm somewhere in there. And there's some set of possible realizations of the CMB sky that include inflation and bubble collisions. And because of this generic signature, I don't really have to know what the precise underlying model is to make progress. Okay? I can look at only these two parts. So there's some expected number. There's the parameters characterizing each collision. And then there's a theoretical prior that tells me roughly how many of each collision type do I expect to find in the CMB. And this is the model. Okay? This is the model that we're going to test now with data. So here's one realization that's completely exaggerated. If we went to the WMAP website and downloaded the CMB data and we saw these blazing huge disks, we'd say, aha, there's bubble collisions and we're done. But in fact, that's not what we see. We see something like this, where there's absolutely no evidence for anything. So the signal has to be buried if it's there. And we want to ask the question, well, does this data set prefer a theory with collisions or does it not? And what any good Bayesian wants in order to evaluate that question is to really try and evaluate the probability for one model given the data against the probability of another model given the data. The two models we're talking about are just lambda CDM and lambda CDM plus some set of these features determined by that probability distribution. And there's a very convenient theory label to describe what we mean by model, and that's this expected number, because lambda CDM is specified by zero. I expect nothing. Now, I should note a technical detail. What I'm actually going to be constraining is the expected number of detectable collisions. Okay? So that depends on the CMB, that depends on the experimental noise, that depends on the parts of the sky that I can see. So this is not exactly the quantity I calculated before, but it's a related quantity. So here's the plan. I start with some data set, and I want to calculate this probability of the expected number given the data. And here's some possible outcomes, okay? So this curve would tell me that I have no detection, because this curve is peaked on zero, that's lambda CDM. These other curves, I could claim something interesting, because the probability at, say, 6 is much larger than the probability at 0 expected collisions. So then I could claim a detection, possibly. And to calculate this quantity, think about what we need to do. We need to test for an arbitrary number of these templates, because this expected number could a priori be anything, at arbitrary positions on the sky, for arbitrary values of these template parameters, the amplitude, shape, size, etc. And this is just completely impossible, of course. So we can't implement the exact calculation. Yeah, absolutely. So these Bayesian methods include a natural Occam factor, which comes from the increased volume of prior space that you need to consider in a model with more parameters. You'll see exactly quantitatively how that works in a second. So what's the solution? Okay, we can't do the exact problem, but we can approximate it. We can do that by first locating a set of candidates so that I don't have to look on the whole sky, okay, using some form of blind analysis. And then we can find an approximation to the probability by integrating over only those regions of parameter space. Part of the parameter space is the region on the sky that give me an appreciable contribution to this probability distribution. If there's nothing there, then you're not going to get a contribution to the probability distribution. To implement this blind search, what we did is to first filter the CMB using a scale-dependent filter. This is a wavelet transform. More recently, we've implemented optimal filters, which give you the maximum theoretically possible signal-to-noise ratio. And these filtered maps have well-defined statistical properties under lambda CDM, so we can really judge the statistical significance of a given candidate versus lambda CDM. And then we can keep only those things that are most significant. We can calibrate the number of false detections we will get by doing simulations. And pictorially, here's how it might work. So here is a simulated CMB sky, and somewhere in here I placed a bubble collision, which you can't see with your naked eye. And then if I look at filters with different scales, I see nothing, until I get to a scale that's appropriate to the size of the collision I stuck in. And then I get a large, statistically significant feature in the filtered map. And that tells me that I should cut this region of the sky out as a candidate. Now, once I've located my candidates, let's say I have just one, I split the CMB sky into the region containing the candidate and everything else. And in this region, in this small patch of data, I calculate this evidence ratio, okay? This tells me quantitatively how much better one describes the theory, by including a single template in this part of the data. Okay? However, that's not the whole picture. I should get here first. So what goes into that? So this likelihood, the probability of the data given the model, contains CMB cosmic variance and instrumental effects. And, of course, an important part of this is the prior. And because of our ignorance, we use a flat prior on the amplitude and shape. But we know the prior on the size and position from theory, so we put that in. And then we can take all of the candidates and derive this incredibly ugly approximation to that full probability distribution. The computed quantities that go into it are just these evidence ratios computed in each patch. So this tells me if I've got a bunch of fits of varying degree of goodness on the sky, how do I consistently sew them together into an expression for the total probability of this theory, which predicts some set of features? So what's the answer? Here is the data that we use, the WMAND data from the WMAP experiment in the 7-year data release. The reason is that this is the highest resolution channel. Here's a filtered version of the data. You can see we have to cut out part of the sky that's due to the galactic emission. And this particular filter is sensitive to things that would be between 5 and 14 degrees were they there. With our calibrations, we find that 11 features pass the thresholds, and they're robust in the sense that it doesn't matter what particular filter function we use. So then we split the sky into these blobs that contain all of the possible candidates, and we compute that big ugly expression for the probability distribution. And here's the answer. The conclusion is clear. This probability distribution is peaked at zero, and what that means is that the data does not support the hypothesis that there are bubble collisions in the CMB. Further, you can constrain theories by looking at the shape of the probability distribution, and what you'll find is that 68% of the probability is located below 1.6. So if you have any theory that predicts there should be more than 1.6 detectable collisions in the WMAP data, then we've put a constraint on that theory. So I'd just like to emphasize that we've gone all the way from the Lagrangian to the prediction in the CMB to the constraint on the theory. So the loop is closed. And this is the first observational test of this idea of eternal inflation. Of course, what's very exciting is that there's a future in this business, because the Planck satellite is currently done taking data, which will be publicly available early next year. And because of this technical nature of my definition of N, the result could change, because the details of the instrument, the quality of the data, et cetera, have changed. So this is going to be a new constraint that comes out of this.
So what would you assume for the distribution of sizes of the collision?
That goes like sine theta. So you see most of these were fairly small. So you got a fairly sizable penalty in the prior. Yeah, Ite? A flat prior on which parameter?
On the amplitude.
Yes.
So what if you do the
different prior? That would change the results. We have ongoing work that will do better than that, as I'll describe in a moment, because we're going to know the exact prediction from an actual simulated bubble collision. Okay, so before I get to that, though, let me just conclude. So what I hope I've shown you today is that non-unique vacua and accelerated expansion give very strong theoretical motivation for this eternal inflation scenario. This idea is testable with observations of the cosmic microwave background, putting things like this, the string theory landscape, squarely in the realm of science. Okay, we're testing it with data. You can approximate the ideal answer, which is the probability distribution over this expected number, using the techniques that I've discussed, and find that there is a real constraint on theories that give rise to eternal inflation. So what's next? First of all, these analysis methods are widely applicable. We've recently submitted a paper to Science which puts constraints on cosmic textures using the same type of algorithm that I've described to you before. Here's our result. The texture theory is described by a symmetry breaking scale, and there's an expected number of detectable textures, which depends both on the cosmology and the instrument. So imposing a flat prior here, we get a result that looks like this, where the shaded regions are the 68 and 95% confidence levels. we can come up with better candidate detection algorithms. In fact, we've implemented optimal filters, which give you the highest possible theoretical signal-to-noise for a given signature, and we found some new candidates. Notice that a few of them are quite large, which is what is expected by the theory, and we're currently analyzing this and very excited to see what comes out in WMAP and then what comes out in Planck. We've made other big improvements to this algorithm that I've described. First, in order to analyze Planck data, the amount of data is going to increase drastically. Okay, there's something like 50 million pixels in Planck. And the RAM requirements to process these blobs goes up dramatically. And so our solution was to look at blobs at a resolution that's dependent on the machine resources we have. Currently, we have quite good resources. I think the biggest machine we can have access to has about 10 terabytes of RAM. So we're really going to be able to do a smash-up job on Planck. There's also a polarization signal of collisions. Okay? And Planck is going to give us data on the polarization. Unfortunately, the signal-to-noise for this signal is going to be quite low. So I think the hopes here are that it could be merely corroborating evidence. And then we have this constraint. Well, what region of theory space have we really constrained? In order to answer this, you really need to do numerical simulations because I have some theory for the potential which gives rise to these collisions, which then gives rise to these templates. And to figure out the free parameters in these templates, I need to connect the loop. This is very reminiscent of what happens in inflation. I have some template for the spectrum of fluctuations, the amplitude, the running, et cetera, and I need some way to determine those from a Lagrangian. Okay? Here you need numerical simulations. And I think this is a pretty novel connection between numerical relativity and observational cosmology. This is the first connection of such type that I know to exist. Sorry, that's a mistake. And there's other possible links between numerical relativity and observational cosmology, which I'm currently exploring with a graduate student here for Bode Cameo. Another question, well, what are the allowed dynamics on the string landscape? What potentials are allowed? Okay. One thing one can do is try and map the landscape. Okay? And one can do that in particular realizations of flux compactifications. And you get something like this, where there's a spiral staircase structure of vacua. And looking at the dynamics, if you include all the moduli of these compactifications, you'll find that some transitions between vacua are forbidden. Okay. In fact, the key to getting transitions is to have strong warping or inhomogeneities of the extra dimensions, which is also something that's invoked often in particle physics to get a large hierarchy of scales between the Planck scale and the electroweak scale. So there could be a connection here. And in general, we want to know, well, what are the rules? What are the possible transitions? String theory invokes extra dimensions, so could that have something to do with this picture? And in fact, it could. Because eternal inflation provides a mechanism to change the effective dimensionality of space. One can find solutions in De Sitter space corresponding to black brains. Here's the event horizon, where on the outside, I have an effectively 10-dimensional universe. And on the inside, I have a 4-dimensional cosmology with a compactified 6-sphere. In fact, these solutions have no singularity whatsoever inside of the brain. And so this is a way of embedding a 4-dimensional cosmology in a higher dimensional world. Here, there's other interesting connections with the cosmology of warping because some of these configurations are unstable. And there might be interesting observational signatures to explore too. But what I'd really like to leave you with and emphasize is that all of these research questions ultimately have something to do with these big questions. And what I constantly have my eye on is how these answers that we are able to find can inform us as to the answer of these bigger questions. And that's really my true ambition. So thank you very much.
How does the prediction depend on the position of Earth in this bubble? Is this because we age or this center? How does the prediction change?
So in terms of these collisions that intersect our CMB sky, where I can see the boundary, it doesn't affect it at all. In fact, that statement of isotropy comes about by considering every possible position inside the bubble with respect to this distribution of outside bubbles.
Regarding your observational method for measuring this disk, mm-hmm. if you apply your method for the synthetic CME map from the London CME,
yes.
So what's the result? It's the same.
So we have a simulation of the WMAP experiment that includes lambda CDM fluctuations, realistic foregrounds. Basically, it's a simulated time stream. So it goes through the same pipeline that's used to make the CMB sky maps. And we set our thresholds for significance by looking at that simulation. And the threshold comes about because we can only process a reasonable number of false detections in the second step. And our threshold is about 10. So we accept about 10 false detections from that simulation. And that sets our threshold on what to pass to this later part of the algorithm.
So you put the constraint also on this. And you have that here, mm-hmm. constraint on the end, mm-hmm. 1.41.
Right.
So what's the result from the
simulation? Yeah, so from the simulation, it's about the same constraint. Yeah. Because most of that shape is due to cosmic variance, effectively. Yeah? Okay.
So going back to the collision and the sort of, you know, the sort of modeling of the collisions, uh-huh. that all looks highly symmetric, right? So a lot of the statements you made, I suspect, are completely reliant on the high symmetry of the problem. Did you sort of look into how robust that was into perturbations or fluctuations around this exact type of solution?
So my group hasn't, but there is a group, so Tom Giblin, who used to be at PI, and Richard Easter, Eugene Lim, and others have looked at field theory simulations in four dimensions. So they don't make the assumption that this symmetry is preserved. And they find that, in fact, this two-bubble solution preserves that symmetry to a high degree of accuracy. Okay, so I think that doesn't get introduced. Now, theoretically, you might wonder, well, what is the probability distribution for making bubbles with, you know, a certain degree of lumpiness or something like that? And that, I think, is quite irrelevant, because if you look at these expanding bubbles, then as a fraction of the total radius, the size of the lumps is shrinking. And that basically comes about from Lorentz contraction and whatnot.
I was thinking more of the gravitational implications. These things, you know, have a lot of energy.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so doing the gravitational problem in 3+1 dimensions is hard, and we haven't gone there yet.
From your 1+1 simulations, what's the energy density?
So we get to pick, but the types of scales in the potential are of order gut scale. So you can imagine the center of mass energy is whatever gamma factor the walls have times the gut scale. So 10 times, 20 times the gut scale for the regions of parameter space we were able to look at. There's a limitation on the center of mass energy, because if you put the bubbles farther apart than Hubble in the false vacuum, they never meet. So the kinematics are determined by the initial separation, which in turn determines the center of mass energy. And the fact that this is all being done in an inflating background puts a bound on the allowed center of mass energy. That depends on the value of the Hubble scale. So.
It must depend on your H, F, and H, I.
Yeah, so it depends on, it depends more on H, F than H, I, I think.
Yeah. Since the first publication of WMAP, mm-hmm. over the years, the famous anomalies, starting it out, what you call multiple direction dependent, half the cold spots.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking to people like Sterling about, they dismiss it by saying it's just statistical anomalies.
Mm-hmm.
Signal to noise ratio is very important.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, data is good enough to make any significant tests.
I think a priori you don't know if it's going to be a significant test. One really needs to go through the exercise of doing it and seeing what comes out. Now, will Planck improve things? I think there is a certain degree of promise that it will. And we're currently simulating CMB skies at Planck resolution with the noise properties for Planck, et cetera, to see exactly how this analysis will improve given that. Now, I should mention one distinct advantage of our analysis over these other types of anomaly searches. And that is we're not a posteriori defining some region of the sky we're interested in or some particular statistic. We really have a direct line from the theory to the observation. And so you really cut out a lot of that uncertainty as to the significance of a given result. The CMB is a large enough data set that if I pick a statistic at random, I might find that that statistic is quite significant under you know, lambda CDM. So this analysis method gets around all of these a posteriori choices that afflict many of these other anomaly searches.
Other question?
Okay. Do you have some words to assure those of us who worry about the fact that in a lot of the analytic cases where we know how to study collisions that are somewhat like this, gravitational plane waves, PK bubbles, we know we get singularity.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying we get something totally smooth here. So is it, you have some words to assure us? Well, you know, following up on Bruce, well, okay, maybe this is exactly true, maybe I'm somewhat excited for you. But a slight perturbation if this all goes.
In the limit where the symmetry holds, it's rigorous because one can just write down all the possible solutions to general relativity plus shells and find that kinematically it's impossible to make a black hole. When you move away from...
Well, no, but you could get a naked singularity, right? Why should you assume that it's a thing shall happen in collision?
Okay, so in order to answer that decisively and conclusively, one has to do these numerical simulations. And I can assure you that for the fairly wide variety of cases, meaning potentials and kinematics that we've studied, we see no such behavior. So there's an analytic proof that that doesn't happen under these approximations, and it's really a proof because I can write down every single solution to Einstein equations with those ingredients. And then I can study these specific numerical cases and see if anything happens. Now, if you had a reason to believe that one particular case would do something like form a naked singularity, well, we could just go and simulate it and find out.
Do these simulations not impose the same symmetry?
Yes, so that was my statement, though, that assuming that symmetry, and then my answer to Ruth's question was that you can do simulations, at least simulations in field theory have been done that test that assumption, and the assumption is found to hold well. Including gravity, one needs to do a lot more work, but my very strong suspicion is that it's irrelevant, that this doesn't matter. I can't give you proof, but you know, just in my experience, that's my guess.
Okay, well, let's thank Matt again.